The story of Ethernet is best told in personal stories shared by its very own creators, providers, and users. The Voices of Ethernet Archive is dedicated to preserving Ethernet's oral history, recording pivotal events that may have been forgotten or remain unknown, through a collection of spoken records with the individuals engaged in the technology's global emergence as the foundation of Internet.
Welcome to another episode of Ethernet Alliance's Voice of Ethernet series. So this morning we have David Cunningham joining us. So David, thank you for joining. Could you please introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm David Cunningham, and over a period of about 25 years, I contributed to various local area networks and LAN standards, namely Ethernet.
And so what got you into Ethernet in the first place, right? Was it a carefully planned career choice? You know, was it you knew exactly what you wanted to do, or was it a little more accidental?
It was probably more accidental from my point of view. I started with Hewlett-Packard Labs in the late 1980s. I was taken on to help develop.
And just checking, given the accent, was that in the US or in the UK?
That was in the United Kingdom. And my first job was to develop the physical layer for a gigabit network using single mode optics. And interestingly, the physical layer chipset I used came from Rick Walker, who many years later developed a 64-66-bit code for 10 gigabit Ethernet.
So you forget that the optics actually came first.
Yes. But unfortunately, as soon as we finished that demonstrator, I mean, it took us 2 or 3 years to get the whole thing going. We had 3 nodes working. It was one of the first gigabit network demonstrators in the world at the time. There were some others, but there were probably about 3 at that time. The feedback from the divisions in Hewlett-Packard, the optics division and the networking division, was that they would prefer that we worked on 100 megabits on multimode fiber and twisted pair. So I got, for my success in helping create the physical layer for the gigabit, I got assigned to work for FDDI, both on the optical PMD and the electrical twisted pair PMD.
Just, and your background before, this was your first job, I'm assuming?
Yes. Well, I had worked for British Telecom for 2 years beforehand on single mode systems, and I'm a laser expert. My PhD was in laser, actually for spectroscopy. So for me, over those years, a lot was learned. I learned about single mode fiber first. But when I started the FDDI contributions, I didn't really know anything about multimode fiber, and I certainly didn't know anything about transmission over copper twisted pair.
So it does tend to be a very large split between the optical people and the copper people. So that transition must have been pretty interesting.
It was, but at that time there were 2 key people, one in the optics division and one in the networking division, who essentially guided and mentored me. One was Dell Hansen, who did a lot for the optics and FDDI. And the other was Pat Thaler, who at that time I think was chair of 10BIS2. So they guided me through the, kept me kind of calm in the technical meetings, because they can be very frustrating. And I was young and argumentative, and sometimes thought that the solutions weren't very good.
So if I run this through, you came through your degree being an expert on light and optics, and then you showed up at HP and got to work on single mode gigabit, and then you got the, that's very cool, but we really need you to go and do this copper stuff because we're selling an awful lot of it.
Yes. And at the time, obviously, at the time, I got assigned to 100 megabits. 10BIS-T was just exploding. And everyone knew that there needed to be a 100 megabit per second network. But no one knew what the protocol would be that would win. So at that time, that's why a lot of fast Ethernet, a lot of it is leveraged from FDDI.
So can you, for those of our audience who don't go that quite that far, can you give us a very quick overview of FDDI?
So FDDI was an optical network. It was originally designed to be a metropolitan network, a backbone network, to connect things like Ethernet local area networks together. It had a dual counter-rotating optical ring. It used light-emitting diodes mainly for the short links. And it ran at 100 megabits per second. And it used a token passing protocol. It was a token ring, similar to IBM's token ring. But it had extra features. The token passing was more robust and more efficient. And it had quality of service features. So you could ensure that real-time traffic could be delivered with specified delays, which in that time era people thought was very important for things like voice and video.
I mean, someone made the point to me, one of the reasons basically made so much sense was they did the deregulation of the telecoms in the US, and all of a sudden there was all this copper that people could use.
Yes, and that was the view of the networking, the vision that Pat Thaler worked for. So they were really interested, and so were lots of other people around the world, in transmitting 100 megabits over exactly the same cable that 10BIS-T was using, which was actually a very poor cable. It was voice grid telephone cable.
What you're saying is at that stage, the Ethernet community started borrowing technologies from other people. Is that right?
Yes. When Fast Ethernet started, FDI Twisted Pair PMD had essentially completed. And so the optics had completed well before that. So the team in Fast Ethernet realized that they didn't have to invent everything themselves. In fact, that would be silly. But in a way, it was mainly the same contributors anyway, because almost all of the experts in the physical layer had worked on FDDI. Then they moved across to 100 megabit Ethernet standard.
Although I wasn't there, I do know that the 100 megabit over copper was pretty controversial. I wonder for our listeners, could you just sort of summarize, where the positions were? And I think when we talked about it, you had a bit of a conversion on the way through this process. So maybe talk us through that.
Yes. So obviously I worked for Hewlett Packard. And Hewlett Packard at that time was very, very keen on using the voice grid cable, which was very challenging. And the solution at the physical layer, which not just myself, but myself and someone called Dan Dove, came up with the solution that we, as part of a larger team, that we would use four pairs and we would transmit in a sort of a ping pong fashion. So it wasn't full duplex, you'd transmit and then receive. And that avoided a lot of crosstalk issues. But to do that, I knew, well, it was always from the beginning, we knew we'd use Ethernet packets. But essentially a new protocol was required, we believed at the time. Again, because of the quality of service issues, you've got to remember, everyone thought that FDDI was actually correct and you needed quality of service. So a new protocol called demand priority token tree was invented, which also passed tokens, but it didn't pass them around a ring. It passed them almost over a star-like network, which we called token tree. And that enabled the same number of priority levels that FDDI had.
So the token tree was basically someone in the middle getting to figure out who was going to send next.
Yes. So there would have been a hub that looked after passing the token up and down. So end stations would request from the master the token, and the master would look around, pull around each of the hubs and give them the token, essentially on a round robin process.
And the standards name that was 100, it was VGAnyLAN, right? 100 VGAnyLAN.
That was the commercial name for that was 100 VGAnyLAN. So this caused great controversy within 802.3 because it wasn't CSMACD. And so that was a period of very robust sets of meetings. Okay. And I think I probably was one of the people that frustrated the traditional Ethernet people, because our physical layer was extremely robust. I mean, no one ever broke it. And the protocol itself is very robust. So it all came to a head at some point, which I don't remember all the machinations, where there was a very big formal meeting that went right up to the executive committee, because the 802.3 itself couldn't resolve the issue. And the executive committee decided to form a new standard called 802.12, demand priority. And so for a while I was shunted off to that standard to work on it. But actually, I had to go to both 802.3 and 802.12 because Hewlett Packard obviously is going to make both. And so both physical layers had to be robust. So I was in a very strange situation with someone like Dan Dove of going to both meetings and making technical contributions to both, which was awkward, to say the least.
There was basically two views on what 100 megabit over copper should be inside of it, sort of three. They were non-resolvable. So it went up one level, and the HPE proposal effectively got its own group.
Yes.
Which, in retrospect, it went off there to die.
But that's in over a period of years, yes, that's what happened. So demand priority had a few years of success, and then probably more years of decline as the fast Ethernet just took over.
Was it mostly technical in terms of cost benefit, or was it mostly political in terms of it wasn't someone else's thing?
Well, I think within Ethernet, it was the fact that it just didn't use the SMICD. It was a very, Ethernet couldn't accept that. Probably 802.3 did never accept that. So that was a reasonable, logical position from them.
So the point of view was it was a different MAC access protocol. Yes. So it's a different group.
Yeah, but in terms of, the cost and to build and use models, it wasn't very much different from Ethernet. So there was no big cost difference or anything like that. The optics for backbones was the same. Used the same copper, or it could use voice grid before Ethernet could. But in the end, what really, I think, made the argument somewhat academic was the realization that switching was the thing that was important. So it wasn't just the Ethernet packet that was important. Switching had become mature, Ethernet switches. And with Ethernet switches, you really just have switches connected by point-to-point duplex links.
Yeah.
And CSMACD in itself becomes less important. So the argument kind of went away. But I think both sides, you could argue, were correct. So VG was wrong because it, in some sense, because it invented a new protocol token tree. What it should have done is do switching.
So the switches effectively deferred all your service decision to something with more brains in the middle. And yes. It really became a set of point-to-point links with a common frame format.
Yes. Now, I'm not an expert in protocols. You have to understand that I was always focused on physical layers. And at some level, to me, it doesn't matter what the protocol is. I've just got to get the bits from one end to the other at a decided bit error rate. But also, I understood what was happening at the upper layers. I had to be somewhat cognizant of it.
So added to that tool went along. And like many other very good technologies, didn't gain a foothold, right? But 100 megabit, 100 base T absolutely did. And so how much were you involved in actually pushing that out the door?
Well, in the end, so in the early years, I would have been very involved in pushing, obviously, VG Anyland. But as time went on, everyone realized that fast Ethernet was more important. So subtly, the marketing teams figured out how to make that switch happen. But by then, I was working on the technical layers for gigabit Ethernet. So, I'm not a marketing person, but I think it was probably a tricky time for Hewlett Packard's marketing division. Because by the time we got involved in the gigabit standards, it was clear that we needed to switch to Ethernet fully.
So if you think about your journey from young, enthusiastic university/research person to competent master of 802.3 process and politics, right, what were the key lessons, do you think?
Well, I think one is to listen to what the other views are and really, truly try to understand what they are, because it's extremely easy, especially when you're young, to get entrenched in your own ideas. And Ethernet is based on, it's a good thing, but it's difficult to cope with individual contributions. Companies can't just walk in and take over. Everyone's expected to be an individual contributor, and all the ideas have to be worked through in a fair and reasonable way. And in the end, you know, it's very difficult because it's quite likely that all of your ideas are not going to be accepted. And there's a learning process, which is kind of strange, that you have to learn to collaborate with the others. And then you'll get some of what you've helped to invent into the standard, but almost always, never all of it.
So you're first on Gigabit Ethernet for single mode, right? Then on fast Ethernet, and then you started working on 10 gig. So I imagine at the time, 10 gig must have seemed like an almost insurmountable technical challenge.
So probably within about 4 months of finishing the Gigabit Ethernet standard, I was asked to consider how we would do 10 gigabit. And there was a very deep intake of breath.
Surprise, right? Yeah, well done, right? Very good on that last one. Here's your next problem.
Yeah, and remember, I think Gigabit was published in 1999 or something like that, and they wanted 10 gigabit by 2002. So all of a sudden, we had 3 years to jump another factor of 10. And we already thought we'd gone as fast as we could. So it was very, very challenging, because not now, you know, things like the lasers definitely weren't as fast as we would like them to be. On multi-mode fiber, which again was very important, we had no idea if we could maintain things like the 550 meter link length that was very important for gigabit Ethernet.
Can you give me a brief, simple to understand description of the real difference between single mode and multi-mode from the signal point of view? Not the physical contraction of the fiber, but what's it do to the signal?
So on a single mode fiber, you basically have one line of sight transmission, basically. So you don't have any reflections other than from connectors within the fiber. So the signal basically transmits from the transmitter to the receiver very cleanly. And it's all you essentially see is a bit of loss, because the fiber, you know, absorbs some of the light. So you put a pulse in and you get almost exactly the same pulse out over the short distances we're talking about. But now if you put a multi-mode fiber in, the light actually reflects within the fiber. And so you get many, many, many reflections. We're talking about hundreds. And so you send a pulse in, and what you get out is a very, very strange looking pulse that doesn't really look very much like the one that you sent in. And so that process is dispersion. And that's what limits the link length on a multi-mode fiber, because at some point the pulse is distorted so much and has become so broad that you can't recover the signal from it.
So how did you attack the problem of 10 gigabit? I mean, apart from swearing and saying, this is not going to happen, right? What did you do next?
Well, again, I was still working for Hewlett-Packard then, so within the Hewlett-Packard team, there was a realization that serial at some point, serial transmission would be important. So we had to have a serial solution, which seemed very challenging. And we had decided we'd definitely work on serial with single mode fiber, because we thought that might be just about possible. For multi-mode, we didn't really believe that 10 gigabits could be transmitted with a single laser at that time. And so we were looking at parallel schemes, either parallel fibers or wavelengths, a number of lasers at different wavelengths. And so the HP contributions, I think, as far as I remember, broke up into those three classes: parallel optics, wavelength division multiplexing, and serial transmission.
I think what you told me at some stage was the trick was trying to figure out what to do, because we didn't know how we'd get the signaling fast enough. And I think you mentioned also there was the trend towards going multiple parallel channels. So can you sort of talk about the move between parallel channels and serial?
Okay. So obviously the reason to use parallel channels is that you can use lasers that have a quarter of the speed. And that made things somewhat easier. But then that creates the problem that the chipsets, the output of the chips has to have, you know, four electrical transmitters, and that creates more power. So that brings with it other things that can cause problems. Serial is almost ideal, because you only have one output port from your chipset, which minimizes the power, but it has to run at 10 gigabits, obviously. And there was some evidence that telecoms at that point in time was transmitting around about 10 gigabits per second with telecoms grid lasers. But our challenge was to try and get lasers that could be economic, because telecoms grid lasers are very expensive. They're cooled and kept at just constant temperature, things like that. We wanted serial lasers that didn't need to be cooled. And also telecoms grid lasers tended to work at 1550 nanometers long wavelengths. We want them to work slightly shorter at 1.3 microns. And they wanted them to be directly modulated. So actually in the background, there was a lot of development within various companies to develop lasers that could be modulated at 10 gigabits, going on in parallel with the standard. And the early prototypes were all based on prototype lasers. They could just about reach 10 gigabits per second.
So, looking backwards from today, there was the initial, the philosophy of 10 times the speed for 3 times the price. And that then led to, after 10 gigabits, right, 100 gigabits was seen as really hard. So that started off as 10 lanes of 10.
Yes.
And so we then see the regular cadence of starting off with highly parallel systems, eventually going down to single, as technology develops.
Yes.
And it's interesting because that seems to have continued. So we had, 10, 40, and 100, right, where 100 was 10 lanes of 10. And then, sort of going 25 to 100, where 100 becomes 4 lanes of 25. And then I think going forward, it sort of goes together. And it's not immediately clear to me why the 1-4 rule is the right one instead of 1-2. But it's got to be better than 1-8 because 1-8 is just complicated to deal with.
Yes. I agree. There seems to be something good about four outputs, but why that is difficult to explain.
So, from your point of view, it was fundamentally a physical way of signaling problem. It was hard to go that fast, and that cleanly at a cost people could afford to buy.
Yes, that's exactly correct. And a thing to remember is around about the time 10 gigabit started. Gigabit Ethernet has assumed that vertical cavity surface emitting lasers at short wavelengths would come into being. And they actually did around the time that 10 gigabits was in the middle of its standardization process. And one of the really good things about those lasers is that they're very small. They have very high bandwidth. And so very early on, it was realized that short wavelengths, we had a source that was potentially very cheap. That could run at 10 gigabits. That caused another problem because the fiber didn't have the bandwidth. I explained before that the type of installed fiber just created too many reflections in it, and we couldn't get the distance we wanted. And that's when new types of multimode fiber were invented.
So thus we get the progression from OM1 to OM2 to OM3, et cetera. I think we're now on OM8, if I recall correctly.
Probably, yes.
And I think, yes, for many of our listeners, they will understand the pain of not knowing exactly which fiber is installed and how long it goes.
Yes. But then the coming into being of high-speed VCSELs, and then probably it was OM4 at the time, that was a great breakthrough, I would say. Well, maybe even a surprising breakthrough, because it came right at the time it was needed. And it was clear that that would change things.
So, David, I'm wondering if you can opine on what actually made Ethernet the success it is. I mean, it's not the original media that Mr. Metcalf described, right? We're not running CCMACD on big, thick copper cable at 25 gigabits. But Ethernet has become the dominant wired protocol. And I'm wondering if you could opine on why you think that is.
I think, actually, it's probably not the physical layer. It's the fact, the Ethernet packet is extremely important. What's transmitted around many networks today, maybe all, is Ethernet packets. So the packet was very important. And that goes right back to the 100 megabit days when people realized that. But then switching, I think switching changed everything. Because with the switches, you could direct the packets in an intelligent way. And I think that that meant that, you didn't need to worry about the protocols anymore. Things like quality of service could be dealt with. Even within telecoms, because you could add qualities of service, you could now use Ethernet within telecom type networks. And so it basically grew. Also, but I think an important thing was the way it was developed. It was developed by a lot of independent contributors who were experts in their own right, and they all added sort of the right things to the standard. But also, I mean, things like management are important, things that maybe aren't even part of the standard. There was a huge installed base of software and systems for managing Ethernet networks, so that could all be leveraged. But then, of course, it is important that the right data rates came along at the right times with cost-effective implementations. So the competition between all the companies within the ecosystem was also, it's not just the standard, it's the competition between the companies to keep costs down and to innovate was very important.
So a couple of points in there spring to mind. So one is the competition between companies. I'm reminded that other technologies, for instance, token ring, were very much dominated by one company, and Ethernet was not. And my guess is that the ethos that evolved of having a whole lot of competitors go work together for a standard and then go sell into the market is probably a key thing that made this successful.
I believe so, because you know, at some level, there was some collaboration within standards, at least among individual experts from different companies. Not formally between the companies, I would say. But then once the standard is done, they all go off and they make their products and they try to sell their products faster than the others, of course. But within that, they all, you know, the standard standardizes certain things. It doesn't standardize everything. So there are always features that different companies can add and different parts of the market they can focus on to find where they can be good. But then in doing that, they learn what customers want and what the next thing the customer needs, which usually then sparks off the next version of Ethernet, funnily enough.
So I'm reminded about, you know, somewhat early in my career, I got the good advice about a document that says you're not done until there's nothing left to take out. And I think that applies to standards, and maybe that's what Ethernet won, because it provided the things you needed, but not anymore.
Ethernet, I think, has an ethos of trying to specify the minimum possible, the minimum necessary. It's hard to do that, but you know, you don't always succeed, or they didn't always succeed.
Clearly, Ethernet has really transformed what we do. Do you follow development today, and is there anything that particularly intrigues you?
Yes, well, I'm a physical layer person, obviously, so I'm very intrigued, and from time to time look at what's happening at the next higher rates, which seem to be 800 gigabits per second. And they're even talking about 1.6 terabits per second. But at some level, I'm glad I'm not involved, because it seems even more challenging than what I had to work on. And those will be done initially with parallel transmission schemes, as we've talked about. But there's also some discussion about moving to 200 gigabits per second serially with optics. And that's going to be very interesting to see how that is done.
And there's a lot of very interesting pieces of technology about to solve this problem, do you go and embed the optics in the package, et cetera? All that physical engineering is complicated and interesting.
Yeah, and just, you're getting to the limits of what silicon itself can do. I mean, you're talking about turning something on and off in a very short space of time.
So what do you think of the idea of what we're doing in terms of capturing people's thoughts?
I think it's very important, because Ethernet has been created by lots of contributors who all probably saw what was happening from a different point of view, because we've all worked on different parts of the standard at different times. And so to get the flavor of that, I think it's good that you capture different people's views and experience. I think it's a very good thing to do.
When we have the context, we sort of understand how it came to be rather than just what it is. And I think that makes a lot of difference, because even if you go past the people like me who work for companies that produce things, I mean, ultimately we build stuff to get used. And the people who use our stuff rely on it every day. And so I think having the backstory matters a lot to people.
Yes.
All right. So, David, thank you for your time. Any final thoughts you'd like to offer?
No, I think I'm finished. I think I've said enough.
Tune in to hear other voices of Ethernet as we continue to document the evolution of Ethernet since 1973 and explore where the technology's story might go next. Thanks for joining.